Seems like only Lucy Liu and Elle are keeping their hands in the killing business. Everybody else is getting out. And Bud is the one that doesn't really make sense. Like, he is keeping his hand in it. He's got his Hanzo sword. He is a badass. He can take the bride down one-on-one, but he's lets himself get just completely shit on by a guy who looks like Abe Lincoln in a Canadian tuxedo. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Movie, another retro coverage. This time we're coming back. We promised it last year. This is part two, our thrilling conclusion of the Kill Bill podcast saga. For Kill Bill 2, it's an American martial arts revenge western, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
It was released in the United States April 16th, 2004. This is its 20th anniversary. It was Quentined and Tarantined by Written Directino. Honestly, a lot of the stuff that is for this movie applies for to the last movie. So if you want to hear the full rundown of the actors and whatnot, check out our Volume 1. But it stars Uma Thurman, David Carradine, Michael Madsen, Daryl Hannah, Gordon Liu returns, this time playing Pai Mei. Samuel L. Jackson is a new character for this one. He's got to get Samuel L. into a Quentin Tarantino joint. And this is something that I pulled on the last podcast, our audience, and I asked them what is their favorite Kill Bill, and nearly 40% of the Bald Move audience said Volume 1 is better, 21% said Volume 2 is better, 32% said equally good, 7% said equally bad. Jim, what's your experience watching Kill Bill Volume 2? Did you see it in the theater? And what's your reflection 20 years back? Which one do you prefer, Volume 1, Volume 2? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I believe I saw this in the theater with friends, and it was a big event back when it came out, much like Volume 1, right? And maybe even more so after Volume 1 came out because of how cool that was. Everybody lost their goddamn minds during this period for Quentin Tarantino. Like, Pulp Fiction was awesome. I feel like not as many people had seen that, but they started seeing it over the years between, and then he hits them with this crazy martial arts kung fu two-parter, and people just loved it. People ate it up.
Yeah.
It still, to this day, has a pretty strong score over on Rotten Tomatoes. It seems like 86% of critics and 89% of the audience like this movie more than they dislike it. I think I'm in that bucket. I think I like this movie more than I dislike it, but just barely. And not quite as much as the first volume.
I can't even remember what I said in the last podcast, but I think that... because I might contradict myself. I'm many. I contain multitudes. I think I like this movie just a little bit better. Like, if I'm going to sit down and watch a movie, I will say that Volume 1 is definitely the more action-packed, pulse-pounding, blood-soaked. The death count is, like, I think there's 50 people that die in the first one, only 3 die in this one, and the bride only kills one person. But this... they backload so much of the bride's development that this... I think Roger Ebert put it best, where it's like... it's they're both great, but the sum of both is more than the individual parts.
Yeah, like, I can buy that.
Yeah.
This feels like the movie. This feels like the movie. The first volume feels like the action parts that they could have left
demo
on the
reel.
Cutting room floor. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, like, it sets the stakes and seriousness and dangerousness of the bride. And it also underpins everything that happens. Like, there's this menace, and, you know, when she's stalking Bud in his trailer, when she's having these lengthy conversations with different people, there's always that menace because you know the violence that she's capable of. And when she's brought low and a few times in this movie, it also tells you how badass Bill and his brother are, for example.
Yeah.
So but if I was just going to sit down and watch one, probably this one, because I think this one easily has the better performances in it. Even though I really liked Sonny Chiba, Is that the guy who was the Hanzo Hattori in the first one? Hattori Hanzo, rather.
Yeah.
The thing is, that might be my favorite scene in the whole whole sequence of the sushi house and the like. If you and your journeys encounter God, God will be cut. That's just such a cool sequence. But overall, the long soliloquies and dialogues and monologues, I tend to eat up in this movie. There's only one that I find tedious on rewatch, and we can probably talk about that. But
I think it's almost unfair to do this. Like, Tarantino intended this to be one movie. Both volumes, and it's almost unfair to dissect it and separate the pieces and say, well, this movie doesn't hold up because it doesn't have the parts from one in it. That's just unfair. If this is taken as a 4+ hour experience, I think all these elements are almost necessary. In fact, I was looking back through this one after I had watched it, thinking, what would I have cut from this movie to get this down to something you could show in a theater, a 3-hour experience maybe?
Yeah.
And I came up short. I couldn't really think of anything aside from maybe cutting out a villain or two entirely and rewriting some of the story, but you'd have to rewrite some things. I think everything he does here to tell the story he's telling is pretty necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. Yeah, I mean, you could do it, but it would definitely make the film lesser. It would make it more one-dimensional.
Is like the one thing. If you don't have her pluck the guy's eye in part one, in volume one, you don't need the Daryl Hannah stuff. You could just get rid of it entirely. But then, how does Bud die? So you'd need, you know, you'd need to rewrite some stuff around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is a hell of a 4-hour experience. The last time I watched it, I went through the year before. I think I talked about this in the first podcast, which, by the way, that's linked in the show notes. If you missed it or you want to review it, I got a wild hair and I'm like, I want to watch all of Quentin Tarantino stuff again, because, you know, I'd seen Pulp Fiction a lot. I'd seen Kill Bill a lot. I've seen Inglourious Basterds of quite a few, but I don't even seen Foxy Brown? Jackie Brown, rather. I've only seen Jackie Brown once. I've only seen Reservoir Dogs once. I'd never seen Death Proof. I'd only seen The Hateful Eight. I remember I really didn't like that movie, but I'd only seen it once, so I went and gave it a try. And this is definitely one of the high points in the marathon. There's not really a low point.
Really? Huh.
I did find that, I don't want to repeat the stuff I said, but yeah, it was, I watched these in one day back to back, and it was a good experience, and it doesn't, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, this is a 2, I intended this to be one movie, and it's like, yeah, no, you didn't. This definitely feels like they did split something down the middle. It kind of feels like Dune that way. It's where it's like, when you get through Kill Bill Volume 1, it doesn't feel like you've heard the whole story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and there's no real resolution to that. I mean, it feels
Bill.
Incomplete.
Bill's not dead.
Yeah, right?
There's a promise made with those words.
And I do appreciate it for a lot of its stylistic stuff. I mean, Tarantino's work, heavily stylized, obviously. Some of that stuff comes across as really just like stomach-churning at times, though, especially in the dialogue. I think The dialogue in this movie is the thing that knocks it down to me being completely lukewarm on it, as opposed to just being over the moon for it. I don't like the dialogue in this movie. And it's
wild.
And it's not necessarily this movie. It might just be Tarantino in general. Yeah. But in his other movies, maybe it's a little more reserved, because he's going balls out with this, with the stylized stuff in this movie. It's maybe more stylized than anything he's ever done.
You think the dialogue in this is more stylized than Pulp Fiction?
Well, okay, so I was going to make this comparison, because in Pulp Fiction, you got Samuel L. Jackson, the mushroom cloud-laying motherfucker. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what you put in that guy's mouth, it is going to come out smooth as a baby's butt. I think Uma Thurman and David Carradine are great actors, and they really showcase that in this movie. But they just don't have that. Whatever it is that Samuel Jackson has, that he can spout Quentin Tarantino's dialogue without batting an eye, and without the audience batting an eye, he's just, I mean, the charisma is off the charts on that guy. And even in this movie, when he's, you know, talking about
being Rufus. Like
his role is totally pointless in this movie. There's no reason for him to be in this movie. But I don't know, man. I look at Pulp Fiction, I say they pulled that off because of Sam Jackson, not because of the dialogue.
Yeah, it's wild to hear you say that because, you know, that's Quentin Tarantino's calling card. Everyone loves his long dialogues and his, you know, it's like Hans Landa versus the French dairy farmer.
Maybe I'm just over it because I remember watching Reservoir Dogs and thinking, oh, yeah, this stuff really hums. This sings, you know.
Interesting.
And then I haven't gone back to Reservoir Dogs in decades. I might feel differently about it now. But having seen this with fresh eyes on it, I just, yeah. It doesn't do, and it's so cringy at times. It feels like this whole movie is the stuff that Quentin Tarantino was writing for himself in Pulp Fiction. And not with the racist stuff, but like just that caliber of writing. It all feels just a little bit less than perfect to me.
Yeah, there's actually I was going to say there's not a lot of racist language, but no, there is. It's just not aimed at African-Americans and black people. It's
Michael Madsen's character is pretty nasty.
Yeah, he has some unkind things to say about Semitic people and Japanese people. But yeah, I guess there's too many. The Tarantino's got a little gun shy with this many Caucasians in the picture. But I don't know. I really like it. I think the dialogue is what makes this movie because there's not a hell of a lot of action. And
true.
I don't know. Just the way there's like David Carradine especially, I think, is good. Like in every scene that he's in this, he really every scene that he's in really sings. Like and just like stuff like, you know, all cock blockery aside. And you know, are you gonna you promise to be nice? It's like I can't be nice, but I'll try to be sweet. I don't know, he's really sells. There's something about this love relationship between him and the bride that feels real, and the arc that Uma Thurman takes with the bride as she gets her revenge and gets the things that she wants and then has this kind of emotional coda and resolution. I think that stuff really works, and it works because you have gone through this 4-hour journey with her and you've gone through heaven and hell to get there. But yeah, I'm interested to see like what is the dialogue you find cringe, because I
it's like
will
all
cop
of it.
To
it,
that
it's so much of it, it just doesn't feel natural. Sam Jackson makes it feel natural, like he's just a guy who speaks this way. In this movie, I don't think that Beatrix Kiddo speaks this way or Bill speaks this way. I see the writer actively writing as these people are speaking these words, and that's not true with Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction.
I feel that way now when I go back and watch some of Kevin Smith's early work. Or I remember when I was younger, I really admired that rapid pitter-patter, pop culture heavy, highly stylized and structured dialogue. But now when I go back and watch like Clerks and Chasing Amy, even Dogma, which I still really admire. I really like Chasing Amy and Dogma, but they're just so raw and unpolished. Whereas Quentin's work, especially when you get to this era,
it's very polished.
It all feels like it's been very polished. It's still very stylized. I don't think real people talk this way either. I do think super assassins
might talk this way.
That have been trained by 1,000-year-old kung fu masters might talk this way. But it's a heightened. This movie is all about heightened reality. Like nothing in this movie is real, but it feels solid. And I think the dialogue it definitely works for me. In terms of everything else, the cinematography is pretty next level. There's just some gorgeous shots of the Southwest. There's some really inventive POVs, and I love the scene of her stalking Bud outside the trailer and how the camera follows and it follows Bud's arousal of what's going on inside. And the music obviously is every music cue is cool and perfect.
I found myself listening all the way through the credits of this movie because the music is just that good.
Yeah, long credit sequence too. It's like over 10 minutes.
Very.
But yeah, I like this. I think it's you can't. Yeah, if any one of these movies was released without the other, it I don't think would be as well regarded. Fortunately, they came out together. So, do we want to get into the meat of this movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Thank you. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
And now, back with more Bald Move. If you haven't seen it before, stop. Go back and watch Volume 1. And then you won't need me to do a non-spoilery introduction for Kill Bill Volume 2, because this is the second half of the movie. So, yeah, if you haven't seen this movie yet, go back and watch both of them, unless you just hate Quentin Tarantino shit or bloodshed and violence. Go on, find another podcast, find another movie. All right, let's just take this chapter by chapter, shall we? Quentin's nice enough, sweet enough to divide it that way and to give us some subheadings to talk about. Chapter 6 is up first, Massacre at Two Pines.
Mm-hmm. And I have to remember that this is not the first... This is the third hour. We're going into the third hour or whatever of this epic movie. This is not the beginning of a movie, because I would say, God, he really wants to get his foot fetish stuff in here immediately. But no, this was intended to be halfway through this. We've already been through the foot fetish experience.
But we get into some gross foot fetish stuff, too. We get into some trampling and some gore
dude,
involving the feet that we'll get to in a later chapter.
Yep.
What I'm always surprised by when I watch this is how much tension there is in that first meeting of Bill and the bride, even though you damn know well what's going to happen. Like, even before Bill shows up and it's just Uma with her friends planning this little shotgun wedding, she's pregnant, you got this pit in your stomach, like, oh, I hope she gets out of this somehow, even though you know.
Yeah, we know she doesn't.
And the way that's the other thing is, like, I also remember, because I saw this opening night with our buddy Peter. Mm-hmm. I remember watching it and, like, I'm kind of amazed this is how it's going, because it seems like this isn't going to end in a massacre. It seems like, you know, Bill's like he's got the answer that he wanted, and nothing goes awry. And then the boy shows up, and I'm not exactly sure where it went wrong, or this Bill being sadistic, you know, that he's letting her think that this is going to be okay and she's off the hook before he lowers the boom.
Not sadistic, masochistic. He's hurting himself here. It almost lulls you into a false sense of security. Like, I get wrapped up in their conversation and their emotions. Like, why did all of this happen? You know, what is the relationship here? Because we don't get any of that in Volume 1. This is all new material. Just knowing who they were to each other. And that stuff really engrossed me until... You know, then, oh, yeah, right, we're watching a massacre. I forgot about that.
Right.
I also think it helps.
The subtitles a couple minutes ago. It says Massacre at Twin
Two Pines. And there was a whole narration about it. The newspapers called it this. I almost think it's funny to me when, you know, she pulls him inside and introduces him, Bill, as her father. Because I'm looking at them and I'm going, yeah, I could almost see it. There's like a certain amount of resemblance there where, that might pass.
The age gap is about right. And he looks like a weirdo hippie dad. He's got the nice suit, but, you know, shirt unbuttoned. He's got the long, shaggy hair, and he looks like David Carradine. Did you know much about David Carradine before you saw this movie?
I mean, I knew he was in The Kung Fu, The Legend Continues.
Because I grew up watching, like, when I was a real little kid. I remember my dad, you know, all of the stuff I got introduced to at a young age is my dad. My mom didn't really watch television. She was a book reader. But he liked watching this stuff on reruns, and he liked that kung fu stuff. And I saw, I remember him being a young man, but, like, he hadn't been relevant. I guess he was a long time unemployed and on welfare when he got the call, and Warren Beatty, who turned down the role of Bill, said, you ought to try David Carradine. I think he would do good. And Quentin Tarantino's like, oh yeah, fucking Kung Fu, The Legend. And
This he turned around perfect. I can't imagine that he ever considered anyone else.
But when I first heard he was cast, I'm like, David fucking Carradine? I cannot believe how charismatic he is and how well he carries these scenes.
Yeah.
Like, it's plausible that a young woman like Uma Thurman would fall under this guy's spell.
Yeah, and to the point where later in the movie where they show kind of earlier stages of their relationship, I'm just like, yeah, I see it. He's got this woman under his spell.
Yeah. Yeah, she is like heart Japanese emoticon hearts in her eyes when they're in that campfire scene that we'll be getting to.
Yeah, which really sells the treachery and the mm-hmm. just every bad thing that's going to happen between them. It really sells the pain of that.
Let's say that Bill had agreed with the Deadly Viper Assassin Squad, the surviving members, that we're going to show up to this chapel strapped and ready to go. But I'm going to go in there and feel it out. You guys stay in the car and maybe we call this all off and go about our separate ways. Let's say that was, I don't know that there's nothing in the text that suggests that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the Deadly Viper Assassin Squad was there fully strapped, ready to go in their black suits implies maybe that was always a foreordained conclusion.
That's how I felt, but sure, I'll go with you.
Because this time I was especially trying to find the exact point in the conversation where Bill has decided, yeah, it's fucking happening.
I think it's when she sees the guy, or he sees the guy she's marrying. I'm like, I can't let this happen.
I think precisely the point is where he talks about being old school, and even though he's widely disrespects the societal contract we have about murder and all that, he does respect some rules and traditions, and he says, isn't it bad luck to see the bride in her dress, you know, in this full dress rehearsal, mm-hmm. and when the young man kind of smiles and says, I like living dangerously, you see like a hardness to Bill's smile set in, and like this kind of like his grin is a lot more wolfish. And to me, if this is even a possible, I think that's the moment where Bill's like, yeah, this is bullshit. But also when you hear his soliloquy at the end about why he does it, it doesn't really jibe with that. But
yeah,
there's definitely a reaction where the young man's like, I like living dangerously. And Bill's like, oh, I know exactly. Yeah. It's
yeah. He might have sealed his own fate there.
What do you think Bud's deal is?
This Bud, is a being Michael Madsen,
enigma.
Bill's
yeah,
brother.
Like, why do you think the Deadly Viper Squad seems to have fallen apart? You know, Vivica the Fox is started a family. Bud's bouncing for a titty bar. Sold his Hanzo Hattori blade.
Though it not seems like really. Ellie.
Yeah, Lucy Liu is over there. Rin Oshi, or Oshi Rin, is running the Yakuza and the crazy 88. Like, the empire's fallen apart.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I almost wonder if it has to do with Bill and Beatrix and they're falling out there. Like, once the gang sees that this is the guy Bill is and I could be next, maybe that group just doesn't have any real trust left. I don't know.
It seems like the BB is it, right? Like that Bill decided to, when he found out that's his child, that like, I got to raise this kid and I'm going to retire. But it doesn't explain why everybody. Yeah, like it seems like only Lucy Liu and Elle are keeping their hands in the killing business. Everybody else is getting out. And Bud is the one that doesn't really make sense. Like, he is keeping his hand in it. He's got his Hanzo sword. He is a badass. He can take the bride down one-on-one, but he's lets himself get just completely shit on by a guy who looks like Abe Lincoln
Larry
in
Bishop.
A Canadian tuxedo. Like,
yeah.
what is his mental state? He hates his brother. He hates Elle. But he's also doing this explicitly because she broke Bill's heart.
Yeah, he's the enigma to me. I can't really tell.
It really is.
Seems to have a grudge against her, maybe because she became Bill's favorite. I don't know. But yeah, Bud is just kind of... Yeah, he's a real enigma to me. Because he lies to Bill and says, I sold my sword, and he's not keeping up on it here in this scene.
Right.
But then we find out later in the movie he didn't do any of that. So is this just because he doesn't want to get recruited? Is he done with the life? But he seems to, you know, still want money. And that'd be a pretty easy way to get some money is say, hey, Bill, if I kill her, if she shows up and I kill her, you know, pay me. But he's very much just like throwing it to the fate.
What if it's just a clue? Because he seems pretty profound and like, you know, well, we deserve death, but then so does she. And she deserves her revenge, and but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It's interesting that in his lie that he tells Bill and everybody about pawning the blade, he says he did it and he got like $200 in El Paso. That's the town the bride was getting married in. Mm-hmm. Almost as if in his fictitious backstory for himself, what they did disgusted him so much that he just like, that's it. I'm pawning the sword and I'm going to bounce a titty bar.
Yeah.
And the canyons of California.
Kind of what I was getting at with maybe it was a trust thing. Like once that trust is broken, you just can't really put it back together. But it could be both, right? It could be the trust wasn't there and Bill's retiring anyway. So screw it. Let's just go our own ways.
I love how the movie takes its time, though, with him. Like, we just see him in this completely pointless existence where he is getting bossed around by strippers, the stripper's boss, just blatantly disrespected. He's living in a shithole trailer with no one, no company, just Johnny Cash at night and a can of cold beans. But he's just existing.
Yeah, and he doesn't have, like, a real fire in him like I would expect an assassin to, although, you know, assassins are probably varied in their lifestyles and their demeanors, but he just like takes it all in stride. He doesn't get pissed off because he has the capability to put that guy in his place if he so chooses.
Oh yeah, like that's the that's one of the pleasures of the film on rewatch, is knowing how much danger this nightclub owner is in. Just like, imagine the like being pulling out in the Bill's car in a Walmart parking lot and fender bender, you come out, god damn it, what you like, you just don't even know what you're fucking with there.
But he doesn't react and that's the thing, he just takes it all, just water off a duck's back, you know. It's and I don't exactly know why, because he probably needs that work. It seems like he does anyway.
Yeah, he seems like a Brad Pitt from Ad Astra type. Like, nothing raises his tone of voice. Nothing raises his blood pressure. He's just zen about everything.
I mean, he's very much like he was in Reservoir Dogs, too. Like, kind of sadistic, kind of just even keel, no sweat, nothing.
Cold-blooded,
Very cold-blooded. I like the touch that he still has this super fancy car, though. He's living out in a trailer in a valley in the middle of nowhere, the desert. The trailer is shitty. He's not drinking like fancy booze or anything. He's mixing up shitty margaritas. But he has what must be a multi-hundred, if not million-dollar car out there.
I saw some interesting commentary that like Quentin Tarantino is really clever with all the snake names. And like that car is named after a type of mongoose, which is one of the few things that can kill a black mamba.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that black mambas are Ellie's California mountain snake is not even a viper. It's not a but it does. It's a known snake eater. It preys primarily on other snakes, and one of its chief prey is, I guess, the Sidewinder, which is Bud's code name.
Okay.
And there's like this interlocking like rock, paper, scissors of the snakes and how they all kind of like eat each other, kill each other. I think it's that's kind of clever. We're kind of talking into it anyway. So let's move on to chapter 7, The Lonely Grave of Paula Schultz.
Yeah.
This is where primarily the titty bar stuff happens. And there's an interaction with Bud and the owner about his stupid fucking shit kicker hat. Did you see the trivia behind that?
No, I guess, know that this Larry Bishop actor is kind of like a staple in certain genres of Quentin Tarantino's that he fancies, I'm sure.
Yeah. I guess Madsen wore that. That was his hat, and he added it to the Bud costume, and he walked in, and Quentin Tarantino's like, "What the fuck is that? What the fuck is, take that fucking hat off." And Michael Madsen said, "No, I ain't that. This is what makes the Bud look." And they had a big fight. So Quentin and he tried and he just wouldn't relent. So as revenge, Quentin added a internal commentary in the movie about how stupid this fucking hat is. I thought it was pretty funny.
I love seeing Sid Haig up at the bar too as the bartender. This guy has got exploitation movies. He comes straight out of that. I mean, now we know him as like Rob Zombie's favorite pet. That.
I didn't know that, Sid. I don't know. Like, I recognize him, but I didn't know why.
Yeah,
he's in a lot of Rob Zombie movies now.
Or was until he died recently. But yeah, he goes back to like Pam Grier movies, like blaxploitation stuff where he was.
Yeah, that's why I've seen him in everything. He was in the Adam West Batman, the old Mission Impossible, the original Star Trek, The Rockford Files, Charlie's Angels, Fantasy Island, Buck Rogers, the 25th, The Dukes of Hazzard, A-Team, MacGyver. This was my childhood. No wonder I recognize this guy.
But he was also in a ton of exploitation stuff. No, he's in the era.
He died a couple years ago at 80.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a treat seeing him.
Yeah.
I kept expecting this scene to amount to something more too, and maybe it is in a sort of roundabout way, but I couldn't help but notice when he's talking with his boss and he's giving him just a face full of grief here. Mm-hmm. There's a shotgun conspicuously leaned up against the wall right behind him, and I'm like, Chekhov shotgun for sure. Mm-hmm. It's been 20 years since I've seen this movie, so I honestly didn't know. The shotgun never comes back. I mean, if you want to say it's a roundabout sort of Chekhov's thing, Madsen used the shotgun to shoot Beatrix in this later in the scene, but like, that's not really a Chekhov thing.
I wonder if there's an implication that he killed everybody before, and that's why he asked Ellie for $1 million, because he's about to go reinvent himself. Because I remember the first time I watched this too, I'm like, this is going to be glorious when he comes back and gets his revenge on these. There's going to be a scene where he just like splatters everybody in his club, and it just never happens.
And here's a bit of writing that I do like, not dialogue wise, although I do kind of like this scene's dialogue as well. I think this shitty boss is written as a really good shitty boss.
Oh, yeah.
I like the little turnabout here where he loses his job, at least for the week, for the indefinitely, right? Till he calls him. And then the guy says, okay, you lost this job. Go out there and talk to Rocket. She's got a job for you. I'm thinking, oh, okay, you know, one door closes, another door opens. He goes out there and talks to her, and he's like, yeah, there's shit water all over the bathroom. Clean it up.
So it was a joke there that, like, he's not really fired. He's just like,
they do need him, but for other things, there's no bouncing to do, but there's shit water to clean up.
Yeah.
He's got an opportunity. He doesn't really need this job, but oh, the opportunity is terrible.
Gotcha. I already talked about it a little bit, but I really like how Quentin Tarantino's camera POV informs the bride stalking him. Like, he comes home and he's walking in, but he feels something wrong because he's a highly trained assassin. He's got the hair centered back in his head, and he looks up, he scans the mountain range and nothing. He goes into the trailer, and the way the camera is situated, you think that the bride's up on that hill and he's like sensor somehow. And when you're watching, you expect to see her like stand up from that, but instead the camera just keeps zooming in on the trailer and then onto the door and then swoops down, and she's underneath it the whole time. Mm-hmm. Which makes you think, she's got the drop on him, but the whole, and then there's that thing where the dogs bark and he looks out and she's right there. And it's a genuinely shocking moment when she kicks in the door, and instead of a sword fight, she just gets the rock salt to the tits and you're done.
And it kicks off, for my taste, the best sequence of this movie. I think its most impressive work as a director is done during the burial scene.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so what happens is he shoots her in the chest with rock salt. He calls up Daryl Hannah. He says, hey, come pick up this sword that I've got tomorrow. And what do you want me to do with her? Make her suffer to her last breath. So what he decides to do is bury her alive. And the burial scene is so viscerally terrifying because of the way it's shot. It's shot in... I mean, we see the whole process that we can see. And then I think the stuff we can't see is even worse. Like, from a oh my God, this is the experience of being buried alive sort of perspective. The visual or the audio in this is brutal. And I was listening to it in surround sound, and they do a really Same. Good job with their surround, feeling like you're in this enclosed space with Earth being poured over, being pulled down, being dropped into this pit, and Earth being loaded over the top of you. It's horrifying.
I remember seeing that in a packed house with a big screen, great surround sound. Yeah. And when that theater goes dark, pitch mm-hmm. black, you could just see like the little lights on the walkways, right? And everyone is like pin drop. And then that first load of dirt hits and just
it's boom, so loud.
Boom. Yeah. It is such, it's so well done. Visceral is the only, because you feel, and if you're claustrophobic at all, like then just a tiny sliver of that thing lit up with her, mm-hmm. you know, like just 3 inches of airspace with that flashlight.
And the pounding of nails to lead up to it is almost deafening. And I can feel myself in that space with that sound. It's amazing. That's an incredible scene. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
And, you know she's going to get out, right? Because you're in the first third of the movie and she's buried. But also your mind is like, how? Like, nothing we have seen from the bride would make you mm-hmm. think she can punch through a half-inch plank of oak and then dig through, you know, 6 feet of dirt.
Yeah, it's and then kind we of brilliant get to in that way. Yep.
And then you're like, what the hell? And then you see Chapter 8, The Cruel Tutelage of Pai Mei, which is up there with the Sonny Chiba Hanzo Hattori for, like, my favorite. It's fun. I think it's funny.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the heart of the heightened realism, where it's like, what if these like wushu masters with the crazy eyebrows that have, you know, with the magic powers, what if they were in our real world of like jets and airplanes and semi-automatic weapons? And I just love it. I love the juxtaposition that there is a secret society like beyond John Wick, where like there's actual magic and things happening.
And this is also where we get to see a little bit more of the magic going on between Bill and Kiddo, Bill and Beatrix. I really like the characterization in this, because I can see the draw on both sides. I mean, this is because I came into this thinking, oh, this is a flashback to before she knew anything. This is her training as an assassin, period. Yeah. But it's revealed over the course of these scenes, she knows a lot. She's a damn good assassin already. She's just not like Pai Mei levels. Exactly. Yeah, this is a doctorate of assassin training. And so I see like both the captivation on Bill's side, but also the captivation on Beatrix's side. And that to me was a real treat and something I kind of needed going through the rest of this movie.
Yeah, you can see that she in this scene, you can see that she genuinely loves him, and you kind of get why. Like he the way that Tarantino paces this scene, because Bill's taking his time telling this story because he knows he's got this girl eaten out of the palm of his hand. He's got the wood flute. He's got, you know, this incredibly fascinating story. And it's such a great introduction to Pai Mei because, you know, this guy's 1,000 years old. You know, this guy completely killed an entire temple of Shaolin monks who, if you know anything about Kung Fu, you know, they are badasses. Uh-huh. Like that's like what they're known for. All the good guys of every kung fu movie you've ever seen. He cleaned out a whole temple just because their master, for whatever reason, didn't return an imperceptible nod that Pai Mei gave him on passing a road. And it's like, and then he tells him, it's like, look, this guy hates foreigners, despises
white
Caucasians, and has nothing but contempt for women. Mm-hmm. And she's like, when she says, how long are you going to stay? He's like, I don't know, whenever he's done. And you're like, okay, a couple months. And he's like, just try to lay low for the first year or two until he gets used to it. So like, he's dropping her off in this situation. It's And then when you find, because I don't know what I was expecting to see.
Right.
But I remember like a ripple of laughter went through the audience when you kind of see this guy who looks like, you know, like something from a video game or from Big Trouble in Little China, sitting there.
Ridiculous.
And he's really funny, but like by, you know, a minute or two in the scene, especially when the montage starts, you're like, okay, I'm taking this Pai Mei guy seriously and his 5-point exploding heart technique.
Well, it has the spirit of like Kung Pao Enter the Fist, right? In everything. I mean, like Kung Pao Enter the Fist was a parody of these old movies. Yes. This is that too. I mean, this character is fundamentally ridiculous, not just in his appearance, because those old masters looked silly in those movies because they were mostly young people in bad old people makeup with huge crazy hair. In this, like, even the way he speaks is ridiculous. Like when he talks about how much he hates Japanese language, right? And it's those styles are only suitable for Japanese fatheads, I think is what he calls them.
Yeah.
It's such a juvenile, dumb way to talk. I love it. I think it's a hilarious character across the board.
Like this guy's so old and so powerful that his privileges, mm-hmm. even though he's clearly educated and cultured, he'd just be a dumb asshole all the time to everyone. Yeah. And no one can do anything to him about it until Ellie comes around, which I want to talk about that here in a minute, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But you talk about the you know, Kung Pao Iron Fist, which one of my all-time favorite movies. God, I wonder if that holds up. That's such... Oh my, we quote that shit.
I don't know.
Like, there's still, like, not a month goes by that I don't say something like, that's a lot of nuts, or something, like, that's a lot of something in that time. But this has got a lot of parody elements, too, because, like, when he really gets her blood up by insulting her, and she gets that sword, and I think he jumps on and, like, stunts on it, mm-hmm. and then she gets serious, she, like, shakes her head, and her ponytail makes, like, the kung fu... And that's when it's like, you know, Quentin's just having fun. Like, that's an objectively hilarious way to start that fight. Before you know, he's got her on the ground screaming about to rip off her arm. It's like, this is my arm now. You're not getting this arm back. And mm-hmm. making her admit that she is utterly helpless before him, which begins the training with like, well, since I own this arm now, I want it to be strong.
Yeah, it's breaking you down so you can build them up. Right. That's that time tested technique.
Yeah. And a really nice touch that because Quentin Tarantino has all these like really interesting connections and payoffs. One of the things that he pays off, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of the game, but when the bride plucks out Ellie's eye, because like Pei Mei is trying to say something, I promise you that when, and she doesn't let him finish, she plucks it out with Pai Mei's right hand. It's essentially as if Pai Mei did it himself because he owns that. He owns that arm.
Yeah, I suppose so. I didn't think about it. And they also introduced the five-point palm exploding heart technique in the scene with Bill. He describes it, which is going to be important later in the movie. But you don't see that, right? All of this is build up. It's supposed to let us know how Beatrix is going to get out of the situation.
Yeah,
that she's in first with the coffin.
She learned that, and there's this whole montage of 3-inch punches where Pai Mei is just making her do this like Bruce Lee exploding 3-inch punch, and it skins her knuckles, makes that she can't even eat with a chopstick. Yeah. I really like that scene of her practicing kung fu, the red background, and then eventually he joins it. Like, that's such a cool, it's just so simple but so cool. The outlines of people doing these, and Uma looks like she's just made out of bone and steel cable.
Yeah.
By the end of this, like she's got, you know, carrying up the water up and down the thing, and she's getting like lean and combat ready beef jerky. And
yeah, I have no complaints about her physicality in these movies. It's impressive.
Dude, when they go back to her being in the coffin and she's preparing that first punch and she makes a fist, did you notice how... I don't say this about many women, but I would not like for Uma Thurman at this era to hit me in the face with that fist. Because there is not a soft surface on that thing.
The knuckles
are the size of Titleist golf balls. Mm-hmm. I actually question if it's actually Uma. I wonder when the pan they hit a cut to have some like really, but because it looks like a battering ram. And when it starts, it's really goofy and stylized, her groundhogging out of the hole.
Yeah, that's wild, but...
But no, you had to love the establishing shot of the graveyard, the fresh grave. And the class, is this actually from a movie? Does this ever happen in? Because like I feel like this is only in like, okay. Because
it's so iconic. In Return of the Living Dead, I believe. This is the iconic zombies rising from their grave.
Outspread, grasping arms, shooting out of the freshly dug grave. It's, you got to know that Tarantino loved that shit too.
Yeah. And that movie's a parody of the zombie genre. So
I love the pacing with the humor, because there's not a lot of humor in this film, but one of the few instances is this, like, this triumphant music that's crescendoing as she's getting out of there, and then the zombie shot, and then this being in a random diner and watching a bride walk across the street just trailing dirt like she's pinpin.
Dude sees her do it. Yeah, he's what,
barefoot,
is this?
Covered hair to toe, and she goes, "I'd like a glass of water." Oh,
I bet
it's
you
so funny. It's so funny.
And I like, so the chopstick scene might seem like it doesn't have much of a point there, other than to just say like how painful this training process is. But I think it also it shows the determination that she's learning through this.
And
to never give up,
grudge,
right? Because she's in a hopeless situation back in that coffin. There's no chance she gets out of this. Yes. But through her training, she remembers it. She learned to be just completely single-minded and focused and never give up.
And it's a scene where you see Pai Mei starting to form a grudging respect. The fact that she won't give up, even though he probably knows, you know, he's done this to hundreds, thousands of students, and he probably knows which one breaks at which point. And he's very, you know, you contrast this to Ellie's experience later.
And I like that too, with the Michael Madsen stuff before she's buried alive. He says, look, I can make this way more painful by spraying this can of mace in your face and then burying you, or you can have this flashlight for whatever reason. And you can see all of this stuff that she's going to learn in the next scene being in use there too. She's thinking, okay, there might be a way out of this as long as I don't make this worse for myself, right?
Yeah. And how do you not like that dialogue where Michael Madsen's just right up in her face, like an inch away, the mace bottle's like, now I'm going to spray this into I'm going to burn your goddamn eyeballs out of their sockets, and you're going to go into the ground screaming and blind.
Yeah.
Or you can have like,
look, I'm not saying there's no good dialogue in this movie. I'm saying
can
large
you point
chunk
it out, because I want to actually try to say, so what about you already said you like Bill and the bride and by the fireside. We like
that scene is good. There's a lot of Bill and Uma later stuff that
I
just think I didn't write down specifics. I just rolled my eyes at it every time I heard it.
Okay.
So we'll see.
I feel like there's one other point. Oh, I want to. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and skip and ask you a question.
Okay.
How the fuck does Ellie poison this man? I feel like this guy with 1,000 years of chi blocking and stuff would just be like, and like green shit would shoot out of his pores, and he'd be like, you think you could poison me? Like, that was the first trick my first student tried. Like, it's such a wild way to kill this powerful man. Just
and
poison.
It feels like they only do it because they want L to be a believable challenge for Beatrix. And I never felt that. I never felt it. Like, she didn't do anything that impressed me, I guess.
There needed to be another scene of like Elle saying, do you want to know how? And she's like, when she plucked my eye out for insolence, I just decided to completely become the best student. And I devoted myself to pleasing him more and being his ultimate student just so I could get him to the point where he would trust me to make a meal, and then I poison. But like, without and you can make that shit up, but like, I feel like there needed to be something, because they built Pai Mei up to be this almost like a cosmic force, like Yoda. Imagine if like one of Yoda's students, like Kylo Ren, finds Yoda and poisons him with his stew. Like, no way. He's too strong in the force.
Beatrix completed his training. We see that Elle never did. So like,
right.
I just wasn't feeling the power levels there. But it's okay, because, you know, ultimately the bride's
going to
be more
powerful. I also know that Quentin Tarantino, from what I can gather, had Harvey Weinstein breathing down his neck to cut this. This is too long. This is too long. Even with two parts, it's too long. So like, maybe there was that, and he was just kept on cutting it.
Could be.
Let's see. Yeah, I think it's time to move on to chapter 9, Ellie and I. This is probably the briefest scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like it, because I think Ellie is a terrible character. Like, Ellie is the worst of the snakes.
That's the thing.
She's like, she acts like she's the best, but she's got the least reason. So it seems like she's the one that Bill's got on the tightest leash, and it pisses me off because she just, the only wins I see her get is through trickery and deceit, which she'll fuck Bud for not seeing that too, but
yeah. And it seemed like poisoning is her thing, and I don't really know what she wants this sword for, because she seems
even
like
when
the
she was
poison
going to
assassin.
Kill even when yeah. she was going to kill the bride in the hospital, she had a syringe. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and
so
you could say, like, well, that's
the
because they wanted to make it look like a stroke or whatever. But no, all of her kills are with
every
poison.
Single one. Yeah, she kills Paimei that way. She kills Bud here with poison. To the point where I think she's trying to pass off Bud's death, like legitimately trying to pass it off as, oh, Beatrix killed him.
Oh yeah, she calls Bill as much. Yeah,
which Bill's a fool to believe that. Like, oh, really? He died of poison. You, the poison yeah. assassin, and he died of poison. You think I'm going to believe that? No. And then she should have been on the outs with, you know, Bill, because that's his brother.
Yeah, and I do. That's the other thing. How did the bad blood and that develop? If Bud loves Bill so much that he'll kill the bride to get revenge for him, and we see that Bill gave him this Hanzo blade with this inscription saying, "Yeah, I love uh-huh. you, or my brother." Like, yeah, how did that go wrong?
Yeah, I think if I was going to take one thing out of the movie, it's this. But then you got to rewrite Bud's death.
Having said that, I did. This is probably the dialogue you're cringing at, her reading about the Black Mamba. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's some cold shit to say to a motherfucker before you kill him. It's not bad. It's not the yeah. worst of it, but yeah, it's a little cringy.
I do love how Bud answers the phone with her when he calls her, and she says, "Bill?" And he goes, "Wrong brother, you hateful bitch." Just the way he just deadpans it. So funny.
Yeah, I don't know why they all hate each other so much after working together, but
it's like Bill. Like, as soon as Bill retired or started raising BB, they just all fell to shit for different reasons.
I love the fight.
Go ahead. Me too.
I do. I don't like most of the fight. I will say I like the resolution of the fight, because
I like the beginning a lot. There's this Jackie Chan aspect of like being in this small trailer, and she mm-hmm. doesn't have the width to draw the sword.
Yep.
So she keeps on trying to get in, like running it, and like, you know. Also, the bride is afraid of this weapon. This is a magic sword that could easily cut her, and she's desperate to try to keep it in its sheath, and they're trying to fight it with just the 6 inches out to slice each other's. I like the physical comedy. Yeah.
Yeah, and the physical comedy just gets heightened and heightened until the climax of it, which I think is even, it's
but
really
we
funny.
Gotta, before we get, yeah, it's very yeah. fun, but it's also funny, like, where Bride's just, like, hitting her with a lamp, she takes Bud's spittoon. Sure.
Ugh.
And hits her in the face. Daryl Hannah's gross is, I think, is so funny. And I think it's also one of the hardest lines of a duology with a lot of hard lines, where Ellie's talking about how I'm going to kill you, and then with the sword in the short future is going to be mine, and Uma hits her with a, "Bitch, you don't have a future." And you mm-hmm. think this is where the fight's going to go to another level, and then the revenge of Paimei happens.
Yeah, when they lock swords, you're like, who's going to get the better of this? And she reaches up and plucks out her other eye.
And this is another experience that I'll, even though it's 20 years ago, I'll never forget the experience of being in this packed house on opening night, and everyone, again, is just kind of like tense and sick, and then that happens. And Elle's reaction, where she just goes ape shit. Like, you hear
starts
this
trashing, like Nick Cage and Mandy, right? With the bathroom.
Yes. She's just this woman screaming in pain while the entire theater is howling in laughter, because this is the funniest way you could possibly resolve this fight.
Totally.
And then the bride just moonwalks out into the desert with bare feet. It's.
And how in most movies it would be like, she clutches her face, she screams, she falls to the floor, the fight's over. Right? But in this movie, like, and she's taking phone calls while this is happening. Like, this is a background, mm-hmm. this is background stuff while Beatrix is going about her stuff in the trailer here, taking her sword back and like squishing her eyes. Disgusting. Ugh.
This is the black heart of his footage. Like Quentin Tarantino absolutely watches videos of Japanese women stepping on baby mice, right?
This is the nexus of the
he's a crusher.
The dark soul that is Quentin Tarantino. It's the violence, the gore, and the foot sex shit coming together to form this black hole that just sucks up everything around it.
I got a pretty strong stomach for that stuff, but I gotta say it's stomach churning when she like you can feel it, right? You can feel it, you know.
Yeah.
And so close up and gross, and it's such a dirty fucking floor, and her feet are filthy.
Yeah.
It's an eyeball. My God.
Why doesn't the bride take both swords? They're both Hattori Hanzo. I mean, I know she takes her sword back, and I get that, but
I want to say it's out of respect for Hanzo. But
she's gonna leave it in the desert here.
Like it's not hers. It wasn't made for hers. It was made. It's made for Bud, and even Bud, as dumb and stupid as he was, understood that and had respect that he wouldn't sell. But like, also, it's like you just leave it in that trailer for anyone to get.
Right. That's what I mean. Like to pawn it for $250 because they don't know its value.
I got a couple behind the scenes things I want to talk about. First off, is Quentin intended to make another movie of these? And I think his falling out with Uma over, and if you wonder, you're like, falling out? We went into this in the last movie. Uma Thurman got hurt, severely hurt in a stunt that Quentin Tarantino personally assured her that she could do and she'd be all right and didn't need a
driving
stunt double.
It's
a driving stunt that happens in this scene. It's about to happen in the movie. But he had this idea of like 10 years later that a blind... Ellie, who had survived the Black Mamba and be able to get out, that has tracked down Verna Green, whoever Vivica tracked down her daughter, yep, who is wanting revenge, training her, and she still had that Bud's Hanzo steel. And I think he had this like kind of like older revenge story, and the BB was going to be grown up, and it's going to be and it just never happened because the interest wasn't there. He was kind of continually worn out from his various projects. And again, him and Uma, which I don't think he could ever do this without Uma. He could never do a sequel to this.
No.
I've heard they've patched things up as of like 2019, 2020, and they're speaking again. But I think that's exactly why, because he was kind of in his mind setting up where there could be a sequel. The other behind the scene thing is that batshit reaction by Daryl Hannah. I guess this was like one of the first takes, and she was deliberately trying to make Quentin laugh. She was just trying to do like this crazy thing, and she did. He broke, and she.
Oh,
and,
I bet.
And that, but that's the take. The one that made him crack up is the one that's in the movie where she's just going extra. She's screaming.
Like,
and she's delusional too. Like she's like, "Bitch, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you.
Good stuff.
All right. Are we ready to go to the last chapter, face to face?
Yeah.
The driving scene in the intro where she's driving in this unspecified Central American country, this is where she gets hurt. Like her tear-assing down this road is where she had the car at. We were introduced to this Esteban Viejo, I think is his name, played by Michael Parks. This is the scene that I don't, especially on rewatch, I find this gratuitous and... kind of unnecessary, but then I was trying to like just as a critical with a critical eye, I was reevaluating it on this watch, and I've got some things to say about it. But my opening salvo is Esteban is almost certainly Bill's actual dad, right?
I would think so.
The way she said, "Oh, he collects like most fatherless boys. He collects many father figures. He was the first. He was a close friend of his mother, who was a prostitute." There's no fucking way that this guy is not Bill's dad.
Seems like it. And just with his demeanor and everything, too.
At this point, because I'm like, this is gross. He's got these, this low-rent brothel, and he's introduced as this fine gentleman, and he's very charming and refined and flattered. But then he talks about cutting women's faces, and he's disfigured this woman's face. And I think this is to remind you at this point in the movie that you might be very charmed by Bill at this point, but don't forget what these men are capable of. They can be charming. They can be suave and well-educated and well-read, but they're also murderous bastards. And
yeah, you really need that reminder going into the end of this, because with the way that this final confrontation plays out, there's a feeling of, oh, maybe Bill's not so bad.
Even if you think he's gone soft moments. Because of his daughter, even if you think that there's going to be like Esteban is there to be like, no, even they don't ever gentle. They just, and it's also kind of an interesting contrast to the bride in this chapter, because one of the many things that happens is he doses her with truth serum and asks her, and like she admits telling the truth that she doesn't believe that her new life would have worked out. It wouldn't have worked out with that nice young man in the record store, because,
well, and it's all tied up in the Superman analogy too. I think like Superman was born Superman, you know, even if he tried to put on the bride costume, like it would never stick with Bill either. Because he is.
But that's
Superman.
The thing. It's like, it's a self-refuting argument, because Superman has made Clark Kent work. Superman did settle down with a weak Earth woman, Lois Lane. I think in the comics, they actually get married.
Okay.
Yeah, so Superman found a way to make it work. I love that. True. That's like, you know, this is like, has entered a pop culture canon now. But like at the time, I remember that was a kind of a profound thought about the nature of, like, everyone else has an alter ego that they pretend to be, but Superman's the real man and Clark Kent is his costume. I mean for comic book analysis, that's pretty profound.
I mean, you could argue you could kind of argue the same about Batman in some ways, that Bruce Wayne is his costume, but
especially now that's the modern way to look at Batman too, but he wasn't born Batman.
Fair. He was turned into Batman.
Superman is Superman. He's Kal-El, to be the technical. But I also think the thing that really works about this is they knocked it out of the park casting BB. This girl is both adorable and able to really do good 4-year-old kid acting, which also I think speaks to Tarantino's strengths as a director. Because I think if I've learned anything in the 15 years we've been doing this, directing children is the most hit or miss thing. And you can have a talented child, but if you don't know how to get a performance out of them, if you don't know how to like put yourself into their point of view and give them the right, like it's almost like stop motion. It feels like with kids, where we got to be like a deeper frown, a little bit more. Okay, that's too. If you just let them do whatever, then you're going to get a 4-year-old's performance. But this gal is rock fucking solid as BB, and it really sells like Uma opening the door and like she expected a million things. This her own child who loves her father, who's having this heartwarming scene that I think it works so well.
Yeah, and everything that they've done with her character leading up to here sells the reaction that she has. She's just stunned. And I think it's hard. I don't know, some of the how good the child actor is in this sort of, and how natural she is as a 4-year-old or whatever. It stands in such stark contrast to the very stilted dialogue in a lot of this scene. The very I won't say stilted, I will say stylized, because understand Tarantino is going for a thing. It just doesn't work on me. And having, you know, a very natural performance from this kid almost, you know, puts that into a starker contrast for me. Makes it stand out even more. And maybe that's what he's going for. I don't know.
But I remember, you know, even watching this, you're kind of thinking like, you know, is this going to be like a happy ending? I mean, it's called Kill Bill, right? Are they going to like have some profound insight? But then as the conversation wears on, you realize that Bill's like that scorpion in the parable with the frog, where it's like he knows this is wrong. He knows this. He's already learned the lesson that if he kills the bride, he'll never be happy. But it's his nature. There's consequences to breaking a murderous bastard's heart. These are the consequences. And even though he knows he's damning himself, he's going to try to kill her. Another behind the scene detail is, I guess Quentin intended to have this elaborate sword fight on a moonlit beach. And Harvey Weinstein said, there's no fucking way that you have the budget nor the time to pull this off. So Quentin Tarantino scaled it down, but played homage to his own idea with having Carradine have this, like, you know, I just know there's a private beach that looks particularly beautiful on a moonlight night. And the moon.
How could you not have the budget for a beach in California?
It's, I mean, I think the total budget for this film was like $30 million. $30 million. Yeah, I mean,
okay.
You know,
I mean, that's
Harvey Weinstein's a monster for a bunch of different reasons. Apparently,
sure, that's not the biggest reason.
Fucking us out of David Carradine, Uma Thurman fights, the least of them. But yeah,
like, I guess you got to wait till a full moon where the moon is particularly bright and get your production crew in there. But there are numerous beaches.
Yeah. Plus, the only thing I could say is it's a little bit of a repeat of the Oren Ishii fight. That was a moonlit and
stylistically,
and like
sure.
And the snow and the tea house. And like, could you make it better than that? But I don't know. I mean, David Carradine has been doing that shit since Uma Thurman's literally in diapers. I would have liked to seen him do some kung fu shit, but I don't know. Maybe the autoerotic asphyxiation has ruined his reflexes and he can't do it no more.
Or age, time. It could
be.
No.
It's definitely the high risk jerking. It's the thing that took him out, man. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
Yeah, Tarantino better watch out for that too with all the feet stuff.
True.
He's doing. Like, did you see, I forgot to mention this, but when she busts in to fight Ellie, did you see the foot cam, the flying foot cam?
Oh yeah, flying,
those dirty
double flying
ass
feet. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. I thought that was really funny, but I know he's jerking it to that. Ugh.
Yeah. It's the eyeball thing that he's really jerking it to.
True.
I imagine you hate all the dialogue, because I love all this stuff where he's talking about, you know, would you have been happy? He's got his Superman soliloquy. He's got the, like, you're a killer and you'd never be satisfied with not killing. And I really like the insert scene, which I always think of, I always think this happens in the first movie where the hit woman comes to kill her in a hotel. But it's actually this, and it's a scene within a scene within a scene of her explaining this stuff with Bill. I love that. That's the last funny moment in the movie where the lady's like trying to fumble with the pregnancy test and trying to read it. And my favorite part is when she slips out the door and says, congratulations.
Through the shotgun hole. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a pretty funny scene.
It's so funny. But that's her like refuting Bill. It's like, no, you can't understand, because you're Bill and presumably a man, what change comes over you when you know this thing is this growing inside of you and it's got to have a clean slate. And I knew you wouldn't give that.
Yeah, you got to live.
You
still
like to die. That's crazy. That's crazy to me. I thought
I will say I like a lot of the thematic stuff he's doing here more than I like the actual words that are spoken.
Is it the delivery? Is it the, like, is there any particular
a lot of it is in delivery. Like, these are two very talented actors. And I think Carradine is pulling this dialogue off better, or at least his character is better suited to this dialogue, because I go back to even the stuff that Uma was doing at the beginning of the first movie with Vivia Fox. I just think all of this stuff is a little too tongue in cheek, a little too stylized, and that every time it's spoken, I just cringe. I can't handle it. But maybe it's because I want to take Kiddo a little more seriously than I'm able to because of the dialogue. I don't know.
I also really think Uma did an incredible job in the early stages of the truth serum of like trying to like will herself not to answer. And it's like it's being ripped out of her in very much the same way
that,
like,
a lot of good work
Pai Mei, when she does that hi and boo, and, you know, like Pai Mei's ripping her arm off and like there's snot bubbling out of her, because they really sell that, like, Bill's talking about how he damned himself by killing the bride, but you really do feel like the bride is kind of damning herself. I believe that Bill is the love of her life and probably the only one on earth that will ever understand her. Mm-hmm. And she's giving all this up so that her daughter can be normal. Like, it's so. Superman wanting his son, like, secretly hoping that you're just a weak human so that you can have normal relationships and be, you know. And you buy that. Yeah. Like, there's the next morning is kind of like the prologue where she's, her daughter's watching TV in a hotel room, which I wonder if it's the same hotel room from Pulp Fiction where Bruce Willis is hiding out. Because it's super fit. I didn't have time to look through all the trivia to find out. But it superficially resembles the room where him and his French girlfriend are hiding out. But mm-hmm. that scene of her on the bathroom floor where she's doubled over in a fetal position, sobbing at what she's done, and it smoothly transitions into borderline hysterical laughter because she's also accomplished her goal and has made her, saved her daughter.
Yeah, the lines earlier from Michael Madsen about which are you filled with right now were ringing in my head in that scene. Is it relief? Oh. Is it regret? And it comes across as something other than either of those, you know, it's a little bit of both, like Daryl Hannah says, but which he calls bullshit on, but it's also, there's something else. It's not relief that Bill is dead and out of her life. And it's not that, right? Cause now this journey is over and she's free to be with her daughter, but it's also not totally regret either. There's some retirement. Third thing there, which is retirement. Yeah, no. Yeah, well, being a mother is not retirement. I'm
true.
I'm pretty certain of that.
Just getting to the hard part.
Yeah. But I don't know. There was a third thing there where it's like I felt her kind of excitement about the new life that she has.
I think we debated this 6 months ago when we did the other podcast. I don't have much more left to say. Do you buy Quentin Tarantino's retiring after his next film because of his, what,
well,
10 film theory?
So let's say this. Kill Bill volumes 1 and 2 are both considered one of his films.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any potential that he does something like that, where he makes the ultimate anthology as his final film? A love letter to the 10 genres he loves the most. So his final film will actually be 10 films that are meant to be viewed as one. Because that's what I could see. He's been redefining what is a film, a Tarantino film, for decades now.
I think that that might happen if he has something this epic. I don't think he would do it just as a way to like have three anthology type films that are completely different in cast, setting, and all that kind of stuff. I just think he's full of shit. I think this is edgelord behavior. Oh, you just, your best way of, you get to be 50 and you're still making movies, you're just going to be a piece of shit. It's like, as Martin Scorsese, he's like 89 years old,
and that's
still
he says in
fucking
his 20s.
Crushing cinema. That's something
that
a young man
says
that thinks 35 is being old, right?
Yeah.
I think he's just, and I can't believe he's still saying, like, doubling that. But also he's a promoter. And I think that, like, that guarantees his final film will get, Daniel Day-Lewis does this shit. He's currently retired, mm-hmm. whatever.
He was
like,
retired
what does
before
that even,
Phantom Thread.
Yeah, what does that even mean mm-hmm. when you are Hollywood famous with millions of dollars and anytime there's no way I believe that Daniel Day-Lewis goes to his grave without performing again. There's no way I believe that Quentin Tarantino makes a 10th movie and then fucks off.
Well, I mean, like, he'll be a special guest director on a film where he directs 99%, right? Because he's done that shit before. He's made more movies than that.
I could see him and Lad Rodriguez doing like a Steven Spielberg, yeah. George Lucas, where it's like George Lucas didn't direct any of the Indiana Jones, but mm-hmm. he was on the set every day. He was behind the camera doing cinematography. He was like, how can you be this creative and love cinema this much and still feel like you got juice that left to squeeze and not squeeze? I just don't buy it. I think this is some bullshit young man edgelord stuff, but it's also promotionally because it's going to guarantee his 10th film is going to be an event, and it's going to guarantee his 11th film is going to be in it. Quentin Tarantino comes out of 4.5 years of retirement to. Yeah,
right.
I don't buy it. I violently don't buy it, but I wish there's a couple things in my life I wish I could go and put immediate odds on. And I wish I could put a bunch of money down on Quentin Tarantino directing the 11th film.
Yeah, I you probably can. I think there are websites for that, but I don't know. It'll probably be in name only that he doesn't direct past a 10th film. We'll see. I have a question for you.
The other thing is, his original quote is he planned to retire by 60, and he's already 61, and he's got a 10th movie, so he's already broken his original plan. Right. Yeah, he's already half broken it.
He's 61? Jesus. He's older than I thought he was.
Yeah. You notice that, like, when people get to a certain age, they stop updating their photo on Wikipedia until they die? Oh, yeah. Like, I noticed, like, Quentin Tarantino, 2015, because he still looks, he could pass for 40. I noticed that with the Julie Dreyfus, who plays the French-Japanese woman in the last one, like, her last was like, 2007. It's like, once you get old, they stop updating your Wiki, until you die, and then they'll find a nice old man photo or old woman photo for you. But, yep. But even then, like, if you go and look at, like, Rita Hayworth or, you know, Marilyn Monroe, they don't do the nope. It's always, like, at the prime. Which, fair enough, I guess. That's what you'd put for their biography cover, but...
Sure. So, did the ending of this movie, you know, the climax is she kills Bill. Surprise, surprise. Yep. With the five-point palm exploding heart technique, he willingly walks into it, you know, he's ready. He knows he's dead anyway. My question is...
I know what you're going to ask.
Could Bill have survived this? Could Bill have never taken those five steps? Because me, I'm looking for the loopholes. I'm like, what defines a step? Can I hop? Does it have to be 1 foot moving in front of the other? Can I get in a wheelchair? Can I wheel around for the rest of my life?
Can I walk on my hands?
Can I walk on my hands? Can I roll?
I don't think in 2004 Bill would survive. But with DoorDash...
You think the accessibility options, like a stairs, like he'd get his wheelchair solution and then stairs would just foil him?
Yeah, no, that's my plan is I would try to get, I try, how many steps I could take to get to my easy chair. And then I'd have someone get me a cell phone and I would just DoorDash all my food. I'd live in a mountain of my own waste, apparently, because I don't know. I haven't figured that out. I guess you need someone that loves you that can bring you diapers and food.
Yep.
That's all you need.
I would at least try it.
I always wondered that, too, because it's it's hokey, right, that you'd hit this. Because I think the idea is that the true idea, if this was a real technique, was the time it would take you to take five steps, you'd die because you've interrupted some vital process. You can only take five steps and you're dead. The idea that you could just sit there and be like, well, shit. I guess I got five more steps. I'm gonna take a moment here, have a conversation with my ex, make sure I look nice. I mean, his blood's coming out of his mouth. Something ruptured here. I don't think he's fine.
For real, yeah. Yeah. No, he's not but fine, is... but he's got a time, not a time limit, but a step limit. I love it because it's like this mythical move, right? It's not.
Yes.
There's no way it could be true in reality. Whatever she did to him is going to kill him eventually, whether he takes the steps or not. But in this mythos, that's a thing. I like it.
And it's so iconic for him to get up with that music and take, and you're counting in the audience. There's not a person alive that's not counting the steps. Yes. And the second his foot touches a blade of grass on the fifth step, he does a stage fall, no less. Like, you know.
Right. He slumps, he spins, he lands face up so you can see him.
Yeah, that's a technique. You spin, you take your weight on your knee, you take it down. Mm-hmm. And what I really love is... in the credit sequence where everyone gets credited and there's an action scene, Bill's the only one who's lying dead. It's just a scene of him lying dead in the grass by the ocean.
Bill, I like that.
David Carradine as Bill. The Snake Charmer. It's his code name.
I didn't really want to end this on a down note, but I have one other thing that I missed in the L part that I wanted
to talk
about.
Scorpion, it's your nature.
True.
It's going to damn you for this podcast, but
this entire first movie, the first volume and through half of the second volume here, every time the bride's name would be said, they censor it. They bleep it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's super jarring and I actually don't like it, but I double don't like it because of the way that they actually reveal it in this movie. It's so unceremonious. Mm-hmm. Like Daryl Hannah just walks in and says, Beatrix Kiddo. Mm-hmm. And then, to make it triple bad for me, they have a flashback to her getting a roll call
in
school
or whatever,
that's just pointless. Just useless, in my opinion. I don't understand this flashback at all. And I don't like anything about how they handled the name of the bride.
Yeah, like Alan Sepinwall says, the game's not worth a candle. Like, yeah, you're waiting for something amazing, and it's just Beatrix Kiddo. Like, it's going to be something that would say something about the character. It's going to say, it's going to change your perception.
You can go back and say she wasn't worthy of a name, or she didn't like earn the name until this point, or like we wanted to keep it a secret because like she's not that person until this point. But none of that rings true to me. All of it rings as gimmick. And I hate it.
It's style and gimmick, and then sometimes Tarantino's a little too close to the Quentin, and it burns him.
Yeah.
There's a couple, like, I think some of these excesses get, I don't know, like, nah, I don't think he's changed at all, because I was trying to think, it's like, maybe these excesses get a little less as, nah, I was thinking about Glorious Bastards and, yeah, and The Hateful Eight and The Django and Once Upon a Time. Like, every single one of these goes off the rails for at least a minute or two.
And the more it goes off the rails, the less I like it. I like Tarantino at about an 8. When he goes to full 10, I can't hang with it.
Yeah. But I can't talk you out of that one. It's that's the thing. It's like I didn't even mind the way it was revealed with the flashback to the, but it's like the more embellished he does it, the more you're left with, why was this a secret? And it's just and there's so many cool mysteries, you know, like who is Bill? Mm-hmm. Like, what was their relationship? The child still alive. What's that like? How's that going?
And I like how he handles all that.
So it's like, why did he need? But I mean, the man suffers from an excess of style and lack of a better word, gimmicks, you know? But I'm glad he does swing for defenses, because when he connects, it really knocks it out of the park. But nobody can bat 1,000. So,
yeah.
All right. I think I'm about done killing Bill.
Me too.
Happy 20th anniversary to Kill Bill. I hope Quentin and Uma, Q and U, can continue to patch things up. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage of the saga. Check out the show notes if you missed the volume one and you want to go back to check that out. We'll be back with another movie before you know it. Lots of stuff coming up on. I think we got Dark Matter.
Yep.
I'll be talking about that on and you know, it's not too much longer before House of Dragon, so it'll be tons of stuff coming out. Appreciate you listening. We'll see you on the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron
and I'm Jim.
See ya.